Chapter 20 Sandecker closed the file and put it down and leaned forward as if he were about to spring. "If you're asking for my permission, the answer is an unequivocal no."
"You place me in an awkward position, Admiral."
The words came from a man who sat facing Sandecker. He was short and seemed almost as broad as the chair. He wore a nondescript black suit with a white shirt decorated by a black silk tie. Unconsciously, every so often, he ran his hand over a bald head as if searching for hair that once might have existed. And he peered through gray eyes that never blinked under Sandecker's blazing stare.
"I had sincerely hoped we would have no disagreement. However, since that is not to be, I must inform you that my presence here is purely an act of courtesy. I already possess the orders for Major Pitt's reassignment."
"By whose authority?" Sandecker asked.
"They were signed by the Secretary of Defense," the other man replied matter-of-factly.
"You wouldn't mind showing me the orders," Sandecker said. He was playing his last pawn, and he knew it.
"Very well," his opponent sighed.
He reached into his briefcase and pulled out a set of papers and handed them to Sandecker. Silently, the Admiral read the orders. Then his lips twisted in a wry smile.
"I didn't really stand a chance, did I?"
"No, you didn't." Sandecker looked down at the papers in his hands again and shook his head.
"You're asking too much.
Too much.
I don't enjoy this sort of thing, but time is a commodity we can't afford. This whole scheme, a naive scheme, spawned by Hermit Limited, is totally impractical. I admit it sounds inspiring and all that. Save the world, build a paradise. Who knows, maybe F. James Kelly has the answer for the future. But, at the moment, he is the leader of a gang of maniacs who have murdered nearly 30 people. And exactly 10 hours from now, he plans to assassinate 2 heads of state. Our course is determined by one elementary fact. He must be stopped. And Major Pitt is the only one who is physically capable of recognizing Kelly's hired killers."
Sandecker threw the papers on the desk.
"Physically capable. Nothing but goddamned words that have no feeling."
He pushed himself from the chair and began pacing the room.
"You're asking me to order a man who has been like a son to me, a man who has been beaten within an inch of death, to get up from a hospital bed and track down a gang of vicious killers 6,000 miles from here?"
Sandecker shook his head.
"You don't know the half of what you're demanding from human flesh and blood. There are limits to a man's courage. Dirk has already done far more than was expected of him."
"Granted, that courage is reduced by expenditure. And I agree that the Major has done more than was thought humanly possible. God knows there are few, if any, of my men who could have pulled that rescue off."
"It could be we're arguing over nothing," Sandecker said. "Pitt may not be in any condition to leave the hospital."
"I'm afraid your fears, or should I say hopes, are groundless." The bald man checked through a brown folder.
"I have here a few observations from my agents, who, by the way, have been guarding the Major."
He paused, reading, then went on. "Excellent physique, constitution like a bull, unique rapport with, the nurses. 14 hours of rest, intensive care, and massive vitamin injections, plus the finest muscle therapy known by the top doctors in Iceland. He has been stitched, massaged, and taped. Fortunately, the only major damage was to his ribs, and at that the fractures were minor. All in all, he's a sorry mess, but I can't be particular. I'd take him if they were lowering him into a coffin."
Sandecker's face was cold and blank. He turned as one of the embassy secretaries poked her head around a door.
"Major Pitt is here, sir."
Sandecker glared at the fat man. Surprise edged into his voice.
"You bastard, you knew all along he would do it."
The fat man shrugged and said nothing.
Sandecker stiffened. His eyes looked resentfully into the fat man's.
"Okay, send him in."
Pitt came through the door and shut it behind him. He moved stiffly across the room to a vacant sofa and very slowly eased into the soft cushions. His entire face was swathed in bandages. Only the slits for his eyes and nose, plus the top opening for a patch of black hair, gave any indication of life beneath the rolls of white gauze. Sandecker tried to look behind the bandages. The deep green eyes that were visible never seemed to flicker. Sandecker sat down behind the desk and clasped his hands behind his head.
"Do the doctors at the hospital know where you are?"
Pitt smiled. "I suspect they'll wonder in another half hour."
"I believe you've met this gentleman."
Sandecker motioned to the fat man.
"We've talked over the telephone," Pitt answered. "We haven't been formally introduced, at least not with proper names."
The fat man moved quickly around the desk and offered Pitt his hand.
"Kipman. Dean Kipman."
Pitt took the hand. It was a fooler. There was nothing weak and fat about the grip.
"Dean Kipman," Pitt repeated. "The chief of the National Intelligence Agency. There's nothing like playing with the big leaguers."
"We deeply appreciate your help," Kipman said warmly.
"Do you feel up to a little air travel?"
"After Iceland, a little South American sun couldn't hurt."
"You'll enjoy the sun, all right."
Kipman stroked the skin on his head again.
"Particularly the Southern California variety."
"Southern California?"
"By 4 o'clock this afternoon."
"By 4 o'clock this afternoon?"
"At Disneyland."
"At Disneyland?"
Sandecker said patiently, "I'm well aware that your destination isn't exactly what you had in mind, but we can do without the echo."
"With respect, sir, none of this figures."
"Until an hour ago, those were our words precisely," Kipman said.
"Just what have you got in mind?" Pitt asked.
"This." Kipman pulled more papers from his seemingly bottomless briefcase and studied them briefly. "Until we were able to question you and the other survivors who were physically up to it, we had only a sketchy idea at best as to the purpose behind Hermit Limited. We knew it existed, and we were fortunate to ferret out a small percentage of their business dealings, but their ultimate goal, the brains, the money behind the entire operation, remained a mystery."
Pitt broke in guardedly.
"But you had a lead. You suspected Dr. Honeywell."
"I'm glad you didn't tumble sooner, Major. Yes, the NIA was trailing Dr. Honeywell. No concrete evidence, of course. That's why we set him up, in the hope he would lead us to the men at the top of the organization."
"Oh, God, it was a setup."
It wasn't easy to combine a sour exclamation with an anguished moan in the same breath, but Pitt pulled it off.
"The whole goddamn scene on that iceberg was a setup."
"Yes.
Honeywell came to our attention when he so thoughtfully provided all the right solutions for Fury Limited's undersea probe, but offered absolutely nothing toward the efforts under development in his own country."
"Then entombing the Lax was a neat little piece of deception," Pitt said. "That was your drawing card. Honeywell was bound to come forward as an investigator when the Admiral here asked him out of what seemed sheer coincidence. Honeywell probably couldn't believe his luck. He immediately volunteered, not to see what happened to his old friend Christian Fury, he'd already guessed that, or to inspect the strange phenomenon of a ship locked in ice, but rather to discover what had become of his precious undersea probe."
"Again, yes, Major."
Kipman handed Pitt several glossy photographs.
"Here are pictures taken from the submarine that kept a watch on the Lax for almost 3 weeks. They show an unusual feature about the crew."
Pitt ignored him and looked up at Sandecker severely and steadily.
"The truth comes out at last. The Lax was found by the search fleet and then tailed until it burned."
Sandecker shrugged.
"Mr. Kipman took the trouble to notify me of that interesting little fact only last night." The tight grin on his griffin-like features hardly indicated friendliness toward Kipman.
"Reproach us if you will," Kipman said seriously, "but it was vital that you both were kept on the sidelines as much as possible. If Kelly or Rontheim or particularly Honeywell had smelled your connection with us, our whole operation would have bombed."
He stared at Pitt, his voice low.
"Major, you were simply to act as pilot and escort for Honeywell while he inspected the Lax. You then were to fly him to Reykjavik, where we would have again taken over our observation of his movements."
"It didn't quite work out that way, did it?"
"We underestimated the other side," Kipman said candidly.
Pitt inhaled on a cigarette and idly watched the smoke curl toward the ceiling.
"You haven't explained how the Lax came to be in the iceberg, nor have you shed any light on what happened to the pirate crew, or given a hint as to how Fury and his crew and scientists could disappear for over a year and then suddenly have their charred bodies turn up on the ship again."
"The answer to both questions is simple," Kipman said. "Fury's crew never left the ship." Sandecker took his hands from behind his head and slowly leaned forward, placing them palms down on the desk in front of him. His eyes were rock hard.
Matagic reported a crew of Arabs, not fair-haired Scandinavians.
That's true, Kipman agreed.
I think if you gentlemen will oblige me by glancing at these photographs, you'll see what I mean about the crew.
He passed the prints to Sandecker and extra copies to Pitt. He then sat down in a chair and lit a cigarette after inserting it in a long holder. Kipman was totally relaxed. Pitt was beginning to think the man would have yawned if he'd been stabbed in the crotch.
Please note photo number one, Kipman said. It was taken with a very sharp telephoto lens through a periscope. As you can see, it clearly shows 10 crew members going about their duties on various parts of the ship. There isn't a dark-skinned man in the bunch.
Coincidence, Sandecker said guardedly.
The Arabs Metagic reported seeing might have been below.
A slim possibility, Admiral, providing we stopped at one picture. However, the other photos were taken at different times and on different days. By comparing them all together, we get a count of approximately 14 men, not one of Arab ancestry. Surely, gentlemen, if there were even one Arab on that ship, he would have had to make an appearance during a 3-week period.
Kipman broke off and tapped his cigarette holder against the rim of an ashtray.
Also, we have definitely identified the faces in the photographs as the same people who set sail on the Lax shortly before it vanished.
And what of Metagic? Sandecker asked, probing. He was a top scientist, trained in accurate observation. Surely he was positive of what he saw.
Metagic saw men who were made up to look like other nationalities, Kipman said. The crew should have been masters of disguise by the time he stumbled onto them. Remember, they had visited a number of ports. They took no chances of recognition. It's only guesswork, of course. We'll never know for certain, but it's fairly safe to say the crew caught O'Reilly watching them and slipped into their phony pose before Metagic came on board for supper.
I see, Pitt said mildly.
And then what?
You can guess the rest, if you don't already know it.
Kipman toyed with his cigarette holder a moment and then continued.
Somehow, it's not difficult to imagine, the Seltinium 279 ignited and transformed the Lax into a floating incinerator. Our submarine could only stand by and watch helplessly. It happened so quickly there were no survivors. Fortunately, the Navy had a fast-thinking skipper in command of the sub. A storm was approaching, and he knew it was only a question of time before the red-hot plates on the Lax's hull cooled and contracted, bursting their seams and letting the seawater flood in and sink her. A finale further speeded by the Force 8 storm building on the horizon. So he turned a $20 million submarine into a tugboat and nudged the burning hulk against a convenient iceberg until it melted its way inside.
Pitt sat there looking at Kipman, his expression pleasant.
Your theory is quite correct, Major, Kipman said thinly.
Not my theory, Pitt smiled. Dr. Honeywell's. It was he who came up with the hot poker in ice proposal.
I see, Kipman said, but he didn't.
The next question that interests me directly, Pitt hesitated, mashing out his cigarette, is why did you send Honeywell and me chasing all over the North Atlantic hunting down a particular iceberg after you erased all of its distinguishable markings? Why did you set Honeywell up to find the Lax and then deliberately try to hide it?
Impassively, Kipman stared at Pitt.
Thanks to you, Major, my men were forced to work their asses off in freezing temperatures, chipping the Coast Guard's red dye marker from the iceberg simply because you showed up 2 days ahead of schedule. You were going over the Lax with a fine-toothed comb and hadn't finished when Honeywell and I appeared on the scene, is that it?
Precisely, Kipman said.
Nobody expected you to fly a helicopter through the aftermath of the season's worst storm.
Then your men were there.
Pitt broke off, looked at Kipman for a long speculative moment, then went on quietly. Your agents were concealed on the berg the entire time Honeywell and I explored the Lax.
Kipman shrugged.
You didn't give us a chance to pull them off.
Pitt half rose from the couch.
You mean they stood by and did nothing when Honeywell and I damn near fell from the berg into the sea, no rope, no help, no encouraging word, nothing?
In our business, we have to be ruthless. Kipman offered a tired smile.
We don't like it, but we have to. It's just that it's the nature of the game.
A game, Pitt said. A fantasy of intrigue? A sport of make-believe dog-eat-dog? You're in a rotten occupation.
A never-ending cycle, my friend, Kipman said acidly.
We didn't start out to be this way. America has always been the good guy. But you can't play white knight when the other side uses every dirty rule in the book. Granted, we're the land of suckers, always believing that good never fails to triumph over evil. But where does that leave us, back in Disneyland?
I'll come to that in due time, Kipman said with restraint. Now then, from what you and the others in the hospital reported, Hermit Limited intends to make their move approximately 9 hours and 45 minutes from now. Their first step will be to assassinate the leader of the Latin American country that they plan to take over, am I correct?
That's what the man said, Pitt nodded, beginning with Bolivia. You shouldn't believe all you hear, Major. Kelly only used Bolivia as an example. He and his group aren't strong enough for a country that size. He's too much of a businessman to make a grab until he is 90% sure of a profit.
The target could be any one of half a dozen countries, said Sandecker. How in hell can you be sure which one it is?
We have computers too, Kipman said with some satisfaction. The processed data narrowed the choice down to 4. Major Pitt helpfully narrowed it down to 2.
You've lost me, Pitt said. How could I?
The models you dredged from the sea, Kipman cut in quickly. One is the exact replica of the Capitol building of the Dominican Republic. The other is the government legislative chambers of French Guiana.
A 50-50 chance at best, Sandecker said slowly.
Not really, Kipman said. It's the honored opinion of the NIA that Kelly and his little troop will try for a doubleheader.
Both countries at once?
Sandecker looked at Kipman inquiringly.
You can't be serious.
Yes, we're serious, and if you'll pardon the expression, we're deadly serious.
What can Kelly hope to gain by splitting his efforts? Pitt asked.
Trying for the Dominican Republic and French Guiana at the same time isn't the gamble it seems. Kipman pulled a map from the folder and smoothed it on Sandecker's desk. On the northern coast of South America, you have Venezuela and British, Dutch, and French Guiana. Further north, a day's passage by boat, a few hours' flight by plane, the island that contains Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Strategically, it's a beautiful situation.
In what way?
Suppose, Kipman said thoughtfully, just suppose a dictator who ruled Cuba also ruled Florida as well.
Sandecker looked at Kipman, his face set and intense. By God, it is a beautiful situation. It would only be a matter of time before Hermit Limited, operating on the same island, strangled Haiti's economy and took over.
Yes. Then, using the island as a base, they could slowly spread into the central Latin countries and absorb them one by one.
Pitt's voice was impassive.
History recalls that Fidel Castro tried to infiltrate the mainland countries and failed on every occasion.
Yes, Kipman repeated. But Kelly and Hermit Limited have the one thing Castro lacked. A foothold. Kelly will have French Guiana.
He paused in reflection a moment. A foothold as sure and as firm as the Allies had in 1944 when they invaded France at Normandy.
Pitt shook his head slowly. And I thought Kelly was insane. The bastard just might do it. He just might pull his fantastic scheme off.
Kipman nodded. Let us say, considering all facts, at the present time the oddsmakers would probably lay their bets in favor of Kelly and Hermit Limited.
Maybe we should let him do it, Sandecker said. Maybe he was somehow meant to have his utopia.
No, it is not meant to be, Kipman said calmly. It can never happen.
You seem pretty certain, Pitt said.
Kipman stared at him and grinned thinly.
Didn't I tell you? One of the birds that tried to kill you in that doctor's office decided to cooperate. He told us quite a story.
It seems there are a number of things you forgot to tell us, Sandecker grunted acidly.
Kipman went on. Kelly's glorious enterprise is doomed to failure. I have it on the best authority.
He paused, his grin broadening.
As soon as Hermit Limited is entrenched in the Dominican Republic and French Guiana, there will be a proxy fight among the board of directors. Major Pitt's passing acquaintance, Mr. Oscar Rondheim, intends to eliminate Kelly, Marx, von Hummel, and the rest, and take over as chairman of the board. Sad to say, Mr. Rondheim's future intentions will hardly be classed as honorable and benevolent.
T.D. was sitting prettily in a wheelchair beside Lily's bed when Pitt entered the hospital room, followed by Sandecker and Kipman.
The doctors tell me you'll both live, Pitt said, smiling.
Just thought I'd drop by and offer my farewells.
You're leaving? T.D. asked sadly.
Afraid so. Someone has to identify Rondheim's triggermen.
You be careful, she stammered. After all you went through to save us, we don't want to lose you now.
Lily raised his head stiffly. Why didn't you say something out there in the ravine? He asked seriously. God, I had no idea your ribs were kicked in.
It made no difference. I was the only one who could walk. Besides, I never fail to get carried away when I have a good audience.
Lily smiled. You had the best.
Pitt asked, How's your back?
I'll be in this miserable body cast longer than I care to think about, but at least I'll be able to dance again when it comes off.
Pitt stared down at T.D. Her face was pale and tears were beginning to well in her eyes, and Pitt understood.
When the big day comes, Pitt said, forcing a grin, we'll celebrate with a party, even if it means I have to drink your old man's beer.
That I'll have to see.
Sandecker cleared his throat.
I take it that Miss Royal is as good a nurse as she is a secretary.
Lily grasped T.D.'s hand.
I'd break a bone every day of the week if it always meant meeting someone like her.
There was a short pause.
I think we should be leaving, Kipman said. Our Air Force transportation is waiting even now.
Pitt leaned down and kissed T.D. and then shook Lily's hand.
Look after yourselves.
I'll be expecting an invitation to that party soon.
He turned his palms upward and shrugged helplessly. God only knows where I'll be able to find a date who'd be seen in public with a battered face like this.
T.D. laughed at that. He squeezed her shoulder and then turned and left the room. In the car on the way to the airbase, Pitt stared out the window, his eyes unseeing, his mind back in the hospital.
He'll never walk again, will he?
Kipman shook his head sadly.
It's doubtful.
Very doubtful. 15 minutes later, without a further word being spoken, they arrived at the Keflavik airfield to find an Air Force B-92 reconnaissance bomber waiting by the terminal. Another 10 minutes and the supersonic jet was speeding down the runway, soaring out over the ocean. Sandecker, alone in the terminal, watched the plane lifting into the azure sky, his eyes following it until it disappeared into the distance of the cloudless horizon. Then, wearily, he walked back to the car.